times the last 2 weeks. So I'm going to ask again. Give me an example of a financial goal that you might have and what you're doing to achieve it. So Melina gave me an example last week, but she didn't tell me what she was doing to achieve it. And that was to get to her goal of giving 50% of my income away. Probably the reason she didn't give me an example of how she was going to achieve it is because that's something we would have to talk about first. But it's actually a very good goal, and I, in all seriousness, that is something that we would like to do probably in my post-get-kids-out-of-college season of life. But anybody think of an example this past week? What is something you're trying to do, and what are you doing to achieve it? Daniel. Okay. Okay. So Daniel's not a plant, but I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. So that's actually a very good goal. We would like to do the same thing when we replace Melina's van at some point. What else are you doing? I suspect there's other things that you will do to achieve that. But you probably have a budget on what kind of car you would buy, too, right?
Well, we don't yet, but we will when we actually get there.
So when you get there, your decision, and the direction I'm going is, if you're going to have a goal like that, you're probably going to go into it realizing that, whatever the number is, you probably have thought through, okay, we're going to buy new or used. That's a question you'd probably have to answer. And I'm not saying specifically for you, but for this type of goal, which is a good goal, but you're going to buy new or used, you're going to buy, you're going to set up, let's say if you go used, you're going to set up an upper price limit and say, we're not going to spend more than this because it would require us to get a loan, right? So there's the path to achieve it and the framework in which you're going to make that decision. And it takes forethought, so a budget to achieve that, some criteria once you get there, but that's a very good one. Anybody else? Nobody else? Okay, yes.
I want to get more admissions.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have planned to do is to open up an account so that
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm asking the Lord to help me to stay sensitive to His leading.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of times I'm thinking, I'd like to give to that. Well, maybe not. But if I know that I have a certain amount of money set aside, and I can get in my mind how much monthly I've got for mission.
Yep. Okay. What Linda's shared is actually very important. I think we tend to think of giving to church and anything beyond that we tend to do emotionally. And like she said, I think there's a good place for being sensitive to the needs of somebody you may not be aware of, right? And I think that and having the flexibility to do that requires planning and requires budgeting. It requires discipline. But I also think we need to be of the mindset that missions is something we're going to commit to ourselves. It's not just something the church supports. And so if you're going to commit to somebody else in terms of missions giving, you know, pick a missionary, somebody that you know, or somebody that your church invests in, planning so that you can support them every month is important. The planning part is important because if you make a commitment to them, they're going to be planning on having that money every month, right, to provide for their needs. So I do think it's important. So that's very good. And I would argue both of those are important, being sensitive to the needs of someone you may not be aware of, but also making the monthly commitment to somebody. And it's a lot easier to do once you get into that habit of doing it. We as a family have monthly missions commitments, and we also, and Melina is really, she both her personally and then with the kids, will just about every year for the last probably 5 or 6 years, we've given money to some other missionary, and it's kind of as a one-time thing. And really that's something that I would encourage you all to do. It should be part of your planning. It should be part of your budgeting, and it needs to be there first. You need to be thinking of the church and missions before you think of other things. And so last week, so with that in mind, and thank you both for having something to prevent me from calling on someone else. Last week we started talking about debt, and I want to conclude the talk about debt today. Now keep in mind, this is not going to be an exhaustive discussion. There may be circumstances that come into play that I don't mention here, or that you may think, well, that doesn't really apply to me, or my situation is a little bit different. And I started this series off by saying, everybody's finances are different. There is no cookie-cutter way. What I want to really do is talk about the principles behind what does stewardship look like. And so, and debt, unfortunately, is a big part of our life. But before I do that, I want to kind of start off by saying, two things. One, I'll say after we talk about debt. Two folks visited with me last week and just had some questions. One was about debt, and one was about giving, and then the idea we touched on what the different lifestyles, living below or above your means, at your means, below your means, and what does that look like? And the question was, well, are you picking on people who are able to enjoy nice things, right? No, I'm not, and I don't want to in any way say that, well, if you see somebody that has a nice car or a nice house or whatever, that they've been a bad steward. If that were the case, I would have been a bad steward, right? I'm a car guy. I told in Daniel's illustration, I said you're going to decide if you want to buy new or used. I'm one of those people that takes the depreciation hit. The kind of cars I usually want to get are hard to find used. So I'm not going to stand here and say, if to being a good steward, you can't have a new car, right? So I think we need to be careful to keep in mind that the way we spend money, you can't just tell by looking at somebody, you know, what their address is or what kind of car they have, or what kind of TV they have, or whatever their passion is for toys, and say, well, they're a bad steward. You don't know. None of us know. Unless I sit down in a counseling situation, I'm not going to know what your financial circumstances are. I guess the only way I might know, as treasurer, I would know, okay, well, this person doesn't give anything to church, therefore, that's one glaring area, and the only reason I mention that is because that is the primary thing that God says we are supposed to be doing. But in terms of what does a person's budget look like, I mean, that's between you and the Lord, and if you're married, it should be between you and your spouse, very specifically. And so, whether you've got a mortgage or a car payment, or you have a car that is drinks a lot of gas and goes fast on the highway, whatever your passion is, that's a very individual decision. And so I want to make sure, even as we're talking about debt, I don't want somebody to come in here and say, well, you know, I don't have a mortgage, and man, all those people that have mortgages, what's wrong with them, right? So there's a very individual personal aspect to this, and I don't want us to lose sight of that. And finally, there are people who do have the ability to give very, very generously and still live a very comfortable lifestyle. And so I think, I had a conversation years ago with a friend of mine. I jokingly refer to this person as a Christian socialist. But they got onto this big beef about how could David Robinson call himself a Christian and live in a 12,000 square foot house. And my response to that was, David Robinson probably doesn't have a mortgage. Do you? You're sitting here and criticizing someone who's extremely wealthy and who gives, and at the time we went to a different church. And I said, are you aware that David Robinson gave our church a couple $100,000 to buy a piece of land? Are you aware of his generosity to other situations? And you don't know what his financial picture looks like. We now know today, after he retired and started investing in the Carver Academy and a lot of other things, that his giving far exceeds, as a percentage of his income, probably anything of what you and I would ever achieve, right? Now, granted, he's very materially blessed, and he's following the principle that we talked about last month, that those who are rich should be generous, right? And so he's doing that. And I use him as an example. We shouldn't look back and say, well, that person is being a bad steward because they live at such and such a level. Because if that's the standard we hold to other people, the entire rest of the world could hold the United States to that standard. Because, again, within the context of the world's wealth, we are all David Robinsons compared to the rest of the world. It'd be very, very easy for the world to say, and in a lot of cases rightly so, that we are poor stewards of our money. So be careful of that before you make an assessment of somebody else's, of my car, okay? Okay, so what is God's view of debt? I'm going to breeze through the first few slides because they're review, and for the sake of time. We talked about the fact that that while a lot of people quote Romans 13:8 when it says, owe nothing to no man, but that actual what God's view of debt is, in Psalms 37:21 says, the wicked borrows and does not repay. The idea of debt is, in fact, not that you shouldn't have debt, but that you honor your debt. And the Old Testament principle that we looked at, that debt was actually something that was not even allowed but encouraged. But it was within a very short-term window. Every 7 years, the requirement was you forgive whatever was outstanding. And so the debt should be done in moderation. It should be done with much prayer. I think I have all of my credit bureaus frozen for identity theft purposes, but I'll tell you, it makes it to where I can't go in and buy anything that requires getting a loan. Not that I would ever do this without talking to Melina about it, but I couldn't just on a whim after work go down and get a Corvette Z06, right? Because I'd actually have to call the credit bureau, pay the fee, have them unlock all my things so I could be able, so they could run my credit to get the loan. I've made it to where no one else can steal my credit for the purposes of running up debt, and I can't do it without forethought. And it's one of those things that it should be. None of us should be making impulse decisions that require debt. We should not. And then we talked about the three lifestyles last week: living beyond your means, which is most of America; living at your means, which is most of the church, and most of the church lives at their means; the goal to be living below your means. And somebody read 1 Timothy 6:17 through 19, just as a reminder. We read this last week. This should be our model. The church in America is very, very, very wealthy, and so this should be our model. So somebody, 1 Timothy 6:17 through 19. Who has that? Okay, Mike.
As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life.
Okay, so if anybody ever has a question about how should I be living, one of the things that I've taken a lot of couples that I've worked with, I've taken them to that passage and say, if you want to start somewhere, start here. And when you've mastered this, you're going to be in a good place, right? Most Americans, most people in the church don't have that mentality. And it's something I have not mastered. But the idea of being, we should be known for our generosity. And again, I'm not talking about everyone should know how much you give to the church. I'm talking about just in general. We should be able to, people should know that, okay, if the world came crashing down around me, you know, my parents would help me. I know that they wouldn't let me and my family starve. I know that they are generous people. Doug and Brenda, those two people that I know of as being generous and hospitable. And I think that's one of those things that is a hallmark of godly Christian character. And it may not be money. I'll pick on Doug just not to embarrass him, but for the past, has it been 3 or 4 years? Doug has delivered firewood to my house. And he would say, well, I'm just trying to clear my land of rotting wood. That may be, but it's a huge blessing to me. I'm one of those people that will turn the air on to have a fire in the winter. And it is, you can burn a lot of wood, especially if you have nothing to do on a Saturday and you have a fire all day long. That can get expensive. And that's an example of, I didn't ask for it. I didn't say, hey, can you take time out of your day to load your truck and show up at my house? I've never asked him to do it, but he was eager and happy to do it because he's a generous person. And that's time and resources. Eventually all that wood will rot and that gravy train will come to an end. But that is that's an example of being generous with your time and resources. We should be known as generous people. When Christ says they will know you by your love, right? Christians should love one another. And we can't say we love each other if we're not willing to acknowledge that what we have is the Lord's and we're willing to share with each other. Okay, so let's, types of debt. We're not going to talk about all these today because we don't have time. But again, this is where we left off last week. Mortgage debt, home equity loans, automobile debt, school debt, unsecured term debt, consumer debt or credit cards, medical bills, tax liability, signature loans or payday loans. These are the kinds of debt that we see, commercial debt, that we see in our society. Most of these are not good. Can anybody think off the top of their head, what's a big difference between, say, mortgage debt and consumer debt?
Collateral,
right? One of the issues is the value of that collateral. Mortgage debt, in most cases, given enough time, the collateral increases in value. On a credit card, what's the collateral? Your new shoes or nothing, right? There is no collateral. It's unsecured. And so if you're carrying credit card, which most Americans do, they have about $10,000 in credit card, the average person. If you're carrying credit card debt, you're carrying debt that's not secured by anything. The number one expense on credit card debt is going out to eat. So not only do you not even have shoes that are wearing out, you're financing something you flushed down the toilet last night. Literally, it is one of the worst things that you can do from a financial perspective, and that is to carry credit card debt. And again, 5 weeks ago when I started this, I went from being the financially advantaged, blessed son of parents who had no debt to having credit card debt that was 50% of my income in about 2 years' time. I've been there. I know what that's like. But it is something, and God was gracious enough to me to allow me to recognize the sin in my own life and fix that before I got married. But it is one of those things that we need at all costs to avoid. Credit card debt is dangerous. It's very, very dangerous. It is the most common kind of debt in the United States. And most likely, most of y'all in here have a combination of mortgage debt, automobile debt, school debt, and credit cards. Now, some of you may not. The gray-haired crowd probably has the least amount of debt anybody in here, as they should. because they've reached the point in their life where hopefully they've achieved the goal of being retirement age and not have any outstanding debt. But this is something that most of us, if you're in that 30 to 40 year, 50 year, and you're raising kids and you're trying to position yourself for retirement, you probably have mortgage debt. So I want to talk a little bit about, are you raising your hand? Sure. So the banks would consider that a debt. So if y'all were to go in and get a loan today, they're going to ask you to fill out a loan application. The loan application is going to ask you, do you own a rent? And then it's going to ask for the amount. Then it's going to ask you if you have any consumer debt, and it'll let you know, car payments, credit cards. It'll ask you if you have any other monthly obligations, because what they're trying to do is determine where do you fall in the debt-to-income ratio. And they're going to add up all those monthly obligations and consider them debts. I picked on Kirsten last week and used the example of a lease payment. All those people who have apartment leases, that is an obligation. It's a debt. Now, you are not getting anything in return, but it is an obligation you signed. You have signed a commitment to repay that loan or that monthly payment. And so, yeah, that's to be considered. Now, most banks, even now after the disaster of 2008, 2009, most banks will let you borrow or let you get into a situation where your monthly obligations or your total indebtedness would be 3.5 times your income. Now, think about that for a minute. So if you had no car debt, no mortgage, or no credit card debt, and you're just going to buy a house, you could get a mortgage of 3.5 times your income. Now, most people don't realize just how big that is, especially in Texas where we have high property taxes. That's a significant amount of money. The trouble a bank will let you get into is insane. Now, interestingly enough, before we move on, when the banks do not consider obligations to charities in that number, that is not a consideration. So if you were to go in, and this is something a Christian should be aware, you were to go in and fill out a loan app, you're going to buy a house, and you put down that you give $500 a month to Redeemer, they're not going to count that. But that's discretionary. So they may approve you for a mortgage, and you may say, well, I can't afford this. I'm having a hard time making my payment. Why? Because they didn't count that $500 that you give to the church as an obligation. Banks don't see it as an obligation. They assume that you will quit giving to your church to avoid being foreclosed on, which is what most people do, right? They're going to do whatever it takes to keep their house. Okay, so let's look at what the Bible says. We touched on a little bit of this last week. Somebody look up Deuteronomy 28:12. So we already talked about the wicked borrow and do not repay. And somebody asked me last week, he said, well, what does the Bible have to say about bankruptcy laws? And so I said, well, the Bible says the wicked borrow and do not repay. He said, well, but sometimes you just can't afford to pay back your loans, and so therefore bankruptcies, you're out. The law may allow that, and it may be perfectly 100% legal. But God says that if you borrow money, you are wicked if you do not repay it. Even if that means your house, you lived in California in 2008 and your house is now worth half what you owe. You borrowed money and therefore you have a biblical obligation to repay it. So there are no qualifications. The wicked borrow and do not repay unless their house value dropped by 50%. No, there's no qualification there. So we talked about that last week. Let's look at this. Somebody read Deuteronomy 28:12. Okay, this is interesting. So people say, well, God hates debt. Really? What does that say? You shall lend to many nations. Now, God says you won't borrow from them. So it's an interesting situation. I know I've had people ask me, so I'm in the I finance tax liens. And admittedly, the kind of people that I'm lending money to, or my company lends money to, are people that are in desperate trouble financially. And I've had people say, well, how do you reconcile that with what the Bible has to say about this kind of, or the idea of being a slave to debt? Because that's people in the situation that I'm in are a slave to debt. Well, this is a great warning. What I do is a great warning for Christians. If you get yourself into this situation, you have become a slave to debt. And God differentiates here what our path should be, right? God tells the Israelites, you shall lend to many nations. What is the advantage of being a lender? Yeah, my dad just went like this, right? Yeah, you get a it's good business, right? It's good business. Lending money, I can assure you, God has provided very generously for me over the last 20 years, and most of those years I've been in some various form of lending. It pays well because loans make a lot of money, right? Banks make a lot of money off lending. But then why would he say, you shall not borrow from those nations? God's worried about the spiritual protection of his people. What would happen if in the days of ancient Israel and they're settling in the land of Canaan and there's these other people who God has told them to do a lot of things or not to do a lot of things, don't marry them. He doesn't want their lives intertwined with them at all from a personal aspect. But if they were to borrow money from somebody, probably they're going to have to put up collateral. This is what you do. The consequences are devastating. If you've got somebody who can control your life in some way, you're more likely to make decisions that don't please God because of the fear of losing your home. And I talked about how banks don't count our tithe as an obligation. God clearly says that it's the first thing we should be doing. We should be giving to the church, or we should be giving to our first fruits to God. That is the first thing that we should do. It should be prioritized above everything else in our budget. If you make a financial decision that compromises that, there is no way you can do it. Well, God wants me to live in this house. Really? Even though you are now unable to give to the church? No, he doesn't. He does not want you to live in this house if you can't fulfill your biblical obligation to tithe. And so I think we need to think in terms of, well, God's worried about the consequences. So Deuteronomy, Daniel, you read that one, right? Deuteronomy 28. Can you read in 28, verse 43 and 48? Yep.
The sojourner who is among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come lower, down lower and lower. What about verse 44?
No. Oh, 43 through 48. I'm sorry. Yeah.
He shall lend to you, and you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. All these curses shall come upon you and pursue you and overtake you until you're destroyed, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord your God and his commandments and statutes that he commanded you. They shall be a sign and a wonder against you and your offspring forever, because you did not serve the Lord your God with joyfulness and gladness of heart because of the abundance of all these things. Therefore you shall serve your enemies whom the Lord will send against you, in hunger and thirst, in weakness, and lack of equity. He will put a yoke of iron on your neck until he has destroyed you.
Okay. The consequences are whoever is going to be lending you money is going to grow in power to where they can exact their will over you. This isn't just a personal issue. I mean, it's a situation our country's in, right? We have $20 trillion in debt. I think people quit caring when it crossed $8 or $10 trillion because nobody has any concept of what $1 trillion is. It's a national security risk, and I don't know why more people don't talk about it that way. We owe the world $20 trillion. We owe the world a debt we cannot repay. So will our debt and drive our foreign policy with people who buy our debt? Absolutely. Just like for us, if we get ourselves into trouble, the decisions we make are going to be driven by meeting our debt obligations. Are you going to engage in a business practice that's unbiblical to meet your debt obligations? Are you going to, like I said, compromise your giving to the church to meet your debt obligations? Are you going to become overrun by keeping all these people outside the church happy because of your poor decisions around debt? And so when you're thinking about, can I afford this house, or can I afford this car, or can I afford whatever, think in terms of what are the consequences. And you can't prevent everything, right? You can't guarantee that you'll never lose a job. But you can structure your life around that. If something happens unexpectedly, that it's not going to send you into a tailspin financially, and cause and put you in a bind where you've got to choose between the lender and God. That's a situation you don't want to be in. And I've sat across the table from people in tears because they don't know what to do. Their life is so, they are slaves, and they are feeling the burden and the weight of their decision. Proverbs 22:7. I'll read that one real quick. Proverbs 22:7. This is a very commonly quoted verse. The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is the slave of the lender. Now, this isn't a, see, God hates the 1% kind of verse. No, this is a practical outgrowth of what happens if you become enslaved to the person who controls the money, right? There's not the richest man who ever lived and who ever will live was Solomon. God doesn't hate rich people. God hates people who are God is warning against the danger of being enslaved to the people, and it's the richer the people who lend the money, just in case y'all haven't figured that out. The rich people lend the money, and they have control over those who borrow. So the caution here isn't don't engage in any kind of debt. We saw in Deuteronomy the freedom and the encouragement to borrow and lend to each other. And we see the freedom, the direction to, from a good business sense, lending to other nations. The danger is enslavement. The danger is getting yourself into a situation where you now are driven by your obligations that you have. It's more of a warning and a caution than it is you've got to avoid debt at all costs. Clearly, God does not oppose debt. He opposes the enslavement that comes with it. If we were all like the Old Testament Israelites and borrowed money that was 7 years or less term, 6 years or less, more likely, we would be have freedom like you couldn't even comprehend. We wouldn't live the lifestyles we do today because we couldn't afford the houses we have. But I've often wondered, is that such a bad thing, right? Debt has allowed us to have nicer things and bigger houses, and we've all accepted it, myself included. We've all accepted that as the norm. And we need to just be more cautious and more considered before entering those types of relationships. So mortgage debt, this has become a necessity in our culture. Again, even if you, yes. No. Yeah, I don't, and I think, and I mentioned last week, Melina and I both look back on our time at our first house, and we don't look back on that as, boy, those were hard years living in a small house. We don't think about it that way. I was no less happy, or no happier, depending in either of those situations. You could argue the 4,000 square foot house just had more work, although we had a maid for a while. That was nice. But sons are four, yeah. But I think the idea of the size, the scale doesn't bring happiness. It's the discipline around it. But it's become a necessity. If you're out of college, you're buying your first house, most people don't have $150,000. Which I think is about the average starter home price in San Antonio, $150,000. They're not going to have it, so it's understandable. I already talked about what the world says we qualify for and what is prudent. Comes back to those three lifestyles. When you buy a house, are you thinking in terms of, can I meet my obligations to church? Can I be generous? Is this going to eat up all of my income? We need to be thinking in terms of those three things. It's an individual judgment call. Again, there's nothing wrong with having a really, really nice house. If you're David Robinson, you want a 12,000 square foot house, more power to you. I have no problem with it as long as it doesn't interfere with what God has called you to do as a believer. And we can't judge David Robinson for his 12,000 square foot house. We don't know his personal financial situation. Just like I wouldn't want somebody in Uganda judging me for my house because they don't know my financial situation. Same thing. Are you meeting your God-given responsibilities? Are you being a good steward? We talked about the dangers of a 30-year mortgage. I mentioned that last week. You know, a 30-year mortgage, there may be certain circumstances where that makes sense. In most cases, it doesn't. I hear a lot of people say, well, I get the tax benefit. Again, if you actually do the math, there is no tax benefit. You're paying extra interest. You're paying a dollar to save 75 cents. So the tax benefit really isn't there. It feels like it is because you get a bigger tax refund or you minimize your tax bill, but you're actually paying more interest than you're minimizing. The other example is, well, I can invest. I can have a 30-year mortgage and rates are 3%. I can invest the difference. In all the years of counseling people, I've not met a single person who actually does that. Now, there are people that do that, and there may be, again, we like to talk about the freedom that it gives to invest. Most people don't do that. Now, some people have the means, and they can literally say, well, I can invest $250,000 over here at 10% versus paying 3% on a mortgage. Then absolutely, it's the right thing to do. Don't throw away that 7%. That's a stewardship issue at that point. It's a stewardship issue. What? Yeah, the 10%. Yeah, I'm still looking for that place. But there isn't. So when I said a 30-year mortgage doesn't make any financial sense, it doesn't make any financial sense for most people. Most people use a 30-year mortgage to live in a place they can't afford. And that is the American way, and it's become the norm because everybody else does it. But like I said, until 30, 40 years ago, nobody did it. It was a shameful thing to have to borrow money for that long, because it meant you were living way beyond your means. We've allowed it to become the norm because that's what we all want. I don't have a 30-year mortgage, so I have a 20-year mortgage in my house, and I regret not getting a 15. Been in my house 8 years. I'd be over half paid off. And when I look back over the last 8 years, my concern was, well, what if my income changes and I can't afford that difference in payment? I would have found a way. And it's one of those things where I look back and think, man, I wish I had done a 15-year. Now, we make 13 payments a year in our house, so effectively, I will have like a 12-year, 15-year mortgage, give or take. But it's one of those things where you think it's a scary thing to do a short-term mortgage if you've never done it. We bought our first house on a 25-year mortgage and refinanced to a 15. I remember being all nervous. Oh, my goodness, 15-year mortgage. This is one of the smartest things we ever did. That's what allowed us to buy the house we have now, because we were able to build so much equity. So are you being a good steward? So a 30-year mortgage may be being a good steward, but in most cases in America, it's not. And it's something we should never, ever, ever refinance your house for another 30-year mortgage. I hear people do that all the time. Oh, I just refinanced my house. Rates dropped. I've been in my house 6 years. I just refinanced for another 30. Oh, my goodness. You just added. If you stay there 36 years in your house. Now, again, if you've got the resources and you're investing the difference, again, that doesn't apply to most of us. Most of us, our house is our biggest investment. But if you refinance, your new term should be shorter than what your old term was, so that you're achieving the goal of being debt-free. Are you content to live somewhere long-term? People who bounce around, rolling their equity into bigger and bigger houses, most times they're not building their net worth. They gain a little bit of equity, they move into another house. They gain a little equity, move into another house. And what they're doing is I put a bigger down payment than my last house. You also borrowed twice as much. You keep upping your standard of living. You're better off staying somewhere and building equity so you can be thinking long term. And did you buy with a plan to pay it off early? Again, how many people in here will be 65 in less than 30 years? I will. Some of you, yeah. I won't ask how many people are already 65. But if you're going to be 65 in less than 30 years and you're going to buy a house, why would you get a 30-year mortgage? If your goal, most people think about retirement at 65. Why would you get a mortgage that extends beyond the point at which you're going to retire, right? You need to be planning to be debt-free. That should be your goal. Because once you're not working anymore, again, you retire. Well, I only have 5 more years of my mortgage, but until then, I'm not going to be able to give as much to the church. That can't be an option. Consumer debt. And we'll go through this. We'll go through this quickly because I know this is. I don't want to carry this over to next week. So if you'll indulge me. Consumer debt is nearly always due to our wants, and you may say, "Well, that's not true." I had, and I'll use myself as an example. Yesterday I went and bought a new water softener. And I was able, we had the money, I just paid cash for it. But I let's say someone will remind me, well, that's not true, our water softener broke and it needed to be replaced and, we have to have a water softener and therefore I had to put it on my credit card. Well, I would say, okay, you mean your life is so tight, your finances are so tight that maybe you didn't have the money for it today. $400 or $500 sitting around you didn't have today. That's when I don't know how many times I've sat down with couples and I said, okay, do you have cable? Well, yeah. I got to watch, whatever, Texas Tech or whatever, there's some things that are super important. I have to have cable. Okay, you have cable. You have money for that. You've been doing that for how many months or years? Did you go out to eat last week? Well, yeah, I got to get out of the house. My wife, she gets tired of cooking, and it's important to our marriage. Okay. And you start asking these questions before you realize it. Okay. You didn't have the $500 for your water softener, not because the water softener was a surprise, but because you've been spending money on other things every month. Month in and month out, and therefore you don't have the $500, right? We don't think in terms of, am I being proactive to avoid it? Proverbs 13:7, we read that 2 or 3 weeks ago. This says, there is the one who pretends to be rich and has nothing, right? That is America to a T. I think I mentioned last week that the average retirement age person has less than $1,000 in savings in this country. Which boggles my mind. I can't even comprehend that. We pretend to be rich and have nothing. That's American culture. That's how we live. We're proud of it. I mean, there's a reason that there are so many expensive cars on the road. When I was at WAMU, I think it's 70 or 80% of home equity proceeds were used to finance luxury SUVs. People buying a luxury SUV on a 15-year term. I mean, people like to display. They want to live like the people who really do have money, right? There's a girl in my office who bought an SUV, like $50,000 SUV. Again, nothing wrong with a $50,000 SUV. But she makes $35,000 a year. And I look at that, I'm thinking, okay, I really did some hand-wringing over the car I bought, which is a fractional percentage of my income, and you bought a car that's more than your income. Like, if I showed up to work with a car that cost more than my annual income, I think the people would think I'd lost my mind, because I would have, right? People like to pretend, well, you know, this other, man, that look at that nice car. I want one of those. What do I have to do to get it? Well, this girl got a 7-year loan on her car. I feel sorry for her. Budgeting and self-control are opposite of credit card debt. If you want to avoid credit card debt, you need to budget and you need to have self-control. Self-control is one of the fruit of the spirits. It's something we should be aspiring to have. We should be self-controlled in everything. And again, nobody's perfect at this. Your budgets are going to be all very individualistic. And there's always room for improvement. You can ask Melina. She could probably come up with 10 ways I can improve in my self-control in budgeting. But the idea, you cannot say I'm self-controlled and I'm living on a budget, but I have credit. I'm carrying credit card debt that I never pay off. They don't go together. Are you covetous? Do you get into debt because you want what someone else has? Again, don't say, well, because, I've tried the excuse, and Melina doesn't buy it, because some people in our church live in Hollywood Park, and I really want to live in Hollywood Park. Doesn't mean that we need to move into Hollywood Park, right? Those the Hermans, Gundersons, living the high life in Hollywood Park. No, I'm teasing them, but I would love to live in Hollywood Park. Melina's like, we don't need to live in Hollywood Park. We're fine where we're at. She also knows that I don't want to give up certain things that would cost more money than what they spent on a house, but we can't covet other people. We can't let that drive us into spending money we don't have. It's important. Somebody read Proverbs 2, verse 3. We'll wrap up with this. Proverbs 2, verse 3. 22, verse 3. Yes, sorry. And actually, while they're looking that up, somebody look up Proverbs 15, 16 through 17. So somebody read Proverbs 22, verse 3, and somebody else look up Proverbs 15, 16 through 17. And with that, we'll end. So who has Proverbs 22, verse 3? Anybody? Okay. Okay, so the prudent sees the evil and hides himself from it. Now, this isn't specifically talking about money, but the trap of money that we talked about, being a slave to debt, being getting yourself into a situation where you can't pay the debt back, God calls that wickedness, right? If you see the evil and you don't hide from it, there's a problem. If there's anything else, if somebody walked into your house with a gun, you probably take evasive action. You would do something to protect yourself. We need to be doing the same thing from a debt perspective, from a financial perspective. But actually, I said Proverbs. I want a different verse. It says Proverbs. But who looked up the Proverbs? No, actually, I'm sorry. Philippians 4, 11 through 13. I'm sorry. I'm trying to rush through. Philippians 4, 11 through 13. This is one of my favorite verses about contentment. Next week, we're going to talk about contentment and then how to build a budget, and that'll wrap up the series. But I want to end us with a look at contentment, because contentment's the key. If you're not content with what you have, you will never be able to achieve any kind of financial freedom or stewardship in your life. You've got to be content. So Philippians 4, 11 through 13. Doug?
Not that I am speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am in to be content. I know how to walk low and how to abound in any and every circumstance. I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance, and need.
Okay, so who's speaking there? Paul, the Apostle Paul, and he's talking to the church in Philippi, and he's telling them that he knows what it means to be content, and it's not the size of their financial support. It's not how comfortable he lives. His contentment comes in Christ. I guarantee you, there is nothing in the world that is going to give to make you happy if you're not content in what Christ has done for you. It will not. And Paul, he understood, had Paul ever lived a wealthy life? Who was Paul before he was Paul? Saul. What society did he come from? Highly educated, from the school of Gamaliel. He was the upper crust of Jewish culture. He ran with the rich and famous of Jerusalem. He went from that to being persecuted. And what he's saying is, I know how to be content in both circumstances, and it comes from Christ. And so it's important. So when you and your spouse or your family, you're talking about finances, if you're not content with where God has placed you, your solution can't be, well, I got to find more money, because this ain't working. Well, more money is not going to fix your problem. I guarantee it. So next week, we're going to talk some more about contentment and what does budgeting look like. And then beyond that, 6 weeks of talking about financial theories isn't going to answer all of your questions. If you have questions, we can do one-on-ones. If somebody has a situation they want help with, that's where you can get personal and individual and unique to your circumstance, and I would love to do that. But let me close this with a word of prayer. Father, we do thank you for today. I thank you for the admonition, how to live our lives, what to avoid. Father, I pray that we wouldn't be naive, but that we would be prudent, that we would see the danger of overindulging in debt and avoid that danger. Father, I pray that we might purpose to be making financial decisions and debt decisions and budgeting decisions that would allow us to be generous, that would allow us to meet our obligations to provide for our family, and that we might be a good testimony with our children, with our coworkers, within our church. Father, we thank you so much for the practical examples we have in Scripture. Pray that we might purpose to live in a way that would please you. And we just pray that you be with us now as we go into the church service. Be with Daniel as he opens up your word to us, and pray this in your name. Amen.